The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
The enemy we have to face down is inflation.
You can't overstate how much a short-term mindset dominates Westminster.
The cost of living crisis is not going away. It's very real for people.
We've got to focus very much on the things that will really bring back growth.
The UK has certainly been a very strong supporter of Ukraine from the outset.
We have to stay the course to make sure inflation falls all the way back to the 2% target.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. Today is one of those days where I read initials and then have to worry if I'm wondering about the right one. Do you think Keir Starmer knew that he was speaking to a union, not a TV programme, when he started his day today?
I did wonder. Well, he's pledging to put good union jobs, his words not mine, at the heart of Labour's energy policy.
So it is the union, to be clear. He's not going on TV.
No, he is not saying Good Morning Britain. But that address does come after stinging criticism from the GMB, don't trip me up, Stephen, General Secretary Gary Smith, who just days ago called Labour policy on oil and gas production naive and lacking in intellectual rigour.
Yes, it was reported at the end of last month that all new oil and gas developments in the North Sea will be banned under a Labour government. Now, that is popular with many city-dwelling Labour activists keen to get on with fighting climate change. It is less popular with union leaders representing some of the thousands of people working in the oil and gas sectors.
Yeah, it's one way to squander an opportunity in Scotland, isn't it?
But there were some very kind of union-targeted comments as well in his speech to the GMB, talking about he wants to see Amazon and others recognise trade unions and that a Labour government would ban zero-hours contracts as well. So some nods at, I suppose, traditional Labour territory in there as well.
Yeah, it's how Labour sort of squares this circle, isn't it? Obviously, the green agenda is hugely important to much of the Labour Party, but there are concerns amongst some of its traditional voters, and that is something that Keir Starmer will be very, very keen to work out.
So Keir Starmer in Brighton, Rishi Sunak on his way to Washington for his first time to visit Joe Biden at the White House. There isn't to expect to be any progress on a US-UK trade deal, but the visit will give the two leaders a chance to reinforce the so-called special relationship. Our UK government editor Alex Morales will be travelling to the US with the Prime Minister. He's brought his wheelie suitcase to the studio with us to give us a send-off before he makes the trip. Alex, great to have you with us. What's in this for Rishi Sunak in this trip?
Well, I mean, as you said, the sort of holy grail of recent Conservative governments is we get a US trade deal. Biden's administration has made it quite clear that that's not on the cards for now. But the UK still thinks that there are all sorts of ways that you can remove trade barriers without striking a full free trade deal. And they've been working on sort of these memoranda of understandings with state level, with states, individual states. But, you know, there'll be things they can do at the federal level as well. You know, that aside, a big ask I'm sure that Rishi Sunak will have of Joe Biden is something on the Inflation Reduction Act, which is Joe Biden's huge package of subsidies and tax breaks for green tech, which has sort of riled.
Can we please have some money?
Well, it's riled politicians in Britain and in Europe who are concerned that it's going to draw away investment to the US that would otherwise go to Britain. So the administration has promised to take the rough edges off, and Sunak will want to know exactly what that means.
Sandpapering at the ready for that.
What about the chemistry between the two leaders? I know we endlessly talk about chemistry between American and British leaders, but it is important, isn't it? What do we know from previous encounters about how these two men get on?
Well, certainly you get the impression that Biden thinks that Rishi Sunak is someone he's more able to work with than Sunak's two predecessors. There appeared to be a bit of antipathy towards Boris Johnson, for instance, because of remarks Boris Johnson made when Barack Obama was president and Joe Biden was vice president. But certainly there's a warmer rapport, but there's always this sort of notion hanging over Joe Biden that he doesn't really like the Brits very much. Certainly that's the perception in Britain. And you know, he mispronounced Rishi Sunak's name when he first came to power.
He's not the first.
Well, no, that's true. He's not prioritised the US a trade deal, which as we all know, is a big UK priority. And when he came to Northern Ireland even last month for the 25th anniversary of the peace deal, he spent most of his time on that trip south of the border in Ireland, sort of exploring his roots. So there's a sense that he doesn't really care that much about Britain. But that said, this will be the fourth time the two men have met in 4 months, which is a pretty intensive level of communication between two G7 leaders. It'll be the fifth time overall, because they also met last year in the G20 in Bali. So there's clearly a close working relationship between them.
I just want to clarify, I meant it's not the first name Joe Biden has mispronounced, but you mentioned Ireland. Do you think that the two leaders are likely to discuss Northern Ireland?
Well, so, I mean, obviously, the Northern Ireland Assembly is still not sitting, and that's a big concern. So, yes, one would think that will come up, but at the moment it seems to be in the hands of Northern Ireland's politicians.
What are some of the other wins that the UK could expect? Are there going to be any kind of easy takeaways?
Well, there are quite a few things sort of rolling around. AI has bubbled up very quickly on the international agenda. Rishi Sunak has made it clear he wants the UK to be a leader in this field. And there's all sorts of speculation that he'll be asking Joe Biden to make London or the UK host to some sort of international body overseeing AI. And there'll be talks about AI regulation. For sure.
And we'll have more about that on the programme later. Another tidbit that I've heard is that he's going to ask Joe Biden about Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, becoming leader of NATO.
Well, number 10 being very coy about that, but I think it seems pretty clear that they support Ben Wallace. Ben Wallace has been open about his desire to take the job, and number 10 is obviously backing him. So one would think that would come up as well.
Do you think Biden would support it?
That's beyond my pay grade. I'm not an advisor to the US president.
Not yet. I mean, who knows by the end of this trip where you may end up. But, those issues around defence more broadly as well is going to be something that we can expect leaders to talk about.
Yes, certainly. And I guess there are two elements to that. One, there's obviously the conflict in Ukraine. The UK has been almost ahead of the crowd on this. It was the first country to offer main battle tanks to Ukraine, and allies then followed suit. Mm. And it's also provided the longest range missiles yet. So you can imagine that the Prime Minister might be trying to persuade Joe Biden to also send longer range missiles of the sort that Ukraine's seeking.
Alex, lovely stuff. Thanks so much for dropping in on your way to see the Prime Minister. Do say hello to him for us.
Yeah, stuff in duty free.
Yeah, not duty free. What, I want to take something from Washington.
A tiny Washington
nerd.
Tacky souvenir.
I'm sure Alex will have loads of time.
A plastic White House, maybe.
White House, that's what we need for the studio.
A snow globe.
Listener, we'll update you if we get that, as promised by Alex Morales.
That's our UK government editor. Thanks for joining us in the studio.
So, for more on what business wants from the Sunak-Biden bilateral, we're joined now by Duncan Edwards, Chief Executive of Trade Group British American Business, who joins us from the Big Apple, New York. Duncan, thanks so much for being with us on the podcast.
Morning. It's good to be here.
So, you're in close contact with officials on both sides. What do you expect to come out of this meeting? Is it going to be all photo opportunities, or will they serve us a bit of drama?
Well, I think first of all, it's a very positive thing. I think this is probably the fifth time that Sunak has met Biden over the last year. And if you think about the lack of contact between UK prime ministers and the president in the preceding 3 years, I think this is a really positive thing. My sense is at the heart of the conversations, as always, will be security, intelligence issues. No doubt there'll be long conversations about the war in Ukraine and the response to China, and particularly the UK's position on China, which is probably a little softer than the US's. But I also think there's going to be conversation about business issues as well and trade issues. Whether the Prime Minister gets what he wants from those will be interesting to see.
Yeah, on the issue of trade, how have we got to the point that a US-UK trade deal is not even on the agenda anymore?
Well, that's really because of policy decisions made by the US, not because of policy decisions made by the UK. So the the Biden administration has made it clear right from the outset that they had no interest in extending trade agreements to anyone. So the UK is not being singled out in this regard. They don't. All the conversations with the EU stopped, and basically any progress on what are seen as traditional, you know, liberalizing trade agreements was stopped under this administration. So, I guess the view here from the administration is that they're opposed to globalization in its broadest sense, that it hollowed out American towns, it removed American jobs, and they, whether they're right or wrong, by the way, and we certainly think they're wrong, that the right approach is to invest in building the American economy for American workers and so on and so forth. And that means no trade agreements. Now, as we've pointed out many times, and I'm sure the UK government has as well, a trade agreement between the US and the UK is extremely unlikely to result in, you know, factories moving from the Midwest to Lancashire because of lower wages. I mean, that's just fanciful. But it's more the sense that trade deals are bad for the working person that has certainly gripped this administration.
Does Rishi Sunak have any chance to change Joe Biden's mind on this then, to perhaps to put that idea in his head? And is that what you're hopeful, that he'll be able to make some progress on?
I think they'll absolutely continue. UK team is going to absolutely continue to make the case that in fact trade agreements have directly the opposite effect than the one I've just described, that they're not a zero-sum game. They actually lead to benefits for both ends of a trade corridor. And I'm sure that he'll continue to make the case, although they've signaled pretty clearly in previous visits. I think James Cleverly was here recently, that they acknowledge that a full comprehensive trade agreement is not within reach. And instead, they're looking for other things. So the UK government has been successfully pursuing a strategy of agreements at a state level, which are not really trade agreements. They don't reduce tariffs or increase market access. But what they do is create a nice warm environment for British companies who might seek to expand into one of these states, that there's going to be a warm welcome for them, and vice versa, by the way. So there was a announcement yesterday, in fact, that the UK government is just started talks with the state of Colorado, which would make it the fifth state that they've got one of these agreements with. So those things are positive. I think there's also a chance that the UK may be granted a carve out under the Inflation Reduction Act for electric vehicles. At the moment, electric vehicles, to qualify for the tax incentive in the US, there are some very, very restricting requirements, particularly around where the materials for the batteries and other materials come from. They need to be sourced either from America or from somewhere with which the US has a trade agreement. And both the EU, Japan, and the UK are looking for a carve out to allow them to be treated as if they had a trade agreement for those purposes. So they may get that. It's not very clear. And frankly, how much that would mean to the UK car industry is I think it's more about signalling than actually the substance of it.
Exactly. Duncan, on these state level deals, I do wonder how much growth they can actually add to the UK or US economies compared to the national level deal that Brexiters once touted as one of the biggest prizes from leaving the EU.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. That's a fair comment. It's definitely second best. I was slightly sceptical about them when they were announced, but having now spent some time with some of the states involved, and there's clearly an opportunity. So for UK companies and, you know, chambers of commerce in the UK and so on. It's a great opportunity. You know, if you've got a group of companies that are looking to expand into the US, which is still for UK companies the most likely place that you will extend as your first overseas location, then there's going to be a warm welcome for you in Indiana, in the Carolinas, and these other places. So I wouldn't dismiss them. There will be good opportunities there.
On the inflation reduction actually you mentioned earlier, clearly the UK and the EU would dearly like the US to give some ground on this, but it's frankly not very likely, is it? What are some of the other things that we could perhaps secure a win on?
I agree. I think it is unlikely. The Inflation Reduction Act is the law in the US, and to change those requirements would require a change in the law, and I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's some other modest wins that are available. There was recently an agreement reached between the UK and the US on recognizing the qualifications of architects mutually. Now, this sounds like a small thing, but it actually really matters. So from now on, British qualified architects can do their work in the US and US qualified architects in the UK. So they're deemed to be equivalent. And it's a good model because at the moment, you know, if you're a civil engineer and you're British, you can't project manage a building a bridge in the US. You need to be recognized and licensed actually at a state level in the US. So there's lots of these kind of things that could be helpful. The US-UK trade and investment relationship remains incredibly strong. It's all of these things that we're talking about would make a positive marginal difference.
Okay.
But the underlying strength is still really robust.
What about things like technology, AI regulation? Is that an issue that we could see some transatlantic cooperation on?
Well, from what I hear, this is certainly an issue that Sunak is going to raise. And my understanding is that he's going to raise the idea that the UK could be a hub for a regulatory body and maybe a research body as well to look at this extraordinary accelerated industry that's just seems to have popped into everybody's consciousness. So I think the US and the UK have a good shot at agreeing on the foundational principles of AI regulation. And if they can agree between themselves, that would be extremely helpful. The relationship between the US and the UK on data and services is so big that anything they agree between themselves has a global impact.
Okay, Duncan Edwards, Chief Executive of Trade Group British American Business. Thanks for joining us from New York.
Well, as we were just hearing there from Duncan, the issue of artificial intelligence and regulation likely to come up in that conversation in the White House. Of course, the advance of the technology coming with warnings about the need for guardrails. Matt Clifford, who created the government's AI task force, says that AI systems could be powerful enough to kill many humans within just 2 years.
Yeah, the IMF's Geeta Gopinath told the FT about the risk of substantial disruptions in labour markets stemming from generative AI. Well, earlier we spoke to Nate Sheridan, who's research fellow at the Centre for AI Safety, about whether we're right to be concerned about AIs causing human deaths and whether speedy regulation is actually happening.
I think speedy regulation is on its way. It's on its way from many quarters. The UK is moving on this. The US is moving on this. And Europe is moving on this. I think it's the right thing to do.
The EU is scrambling to regulate. They've got a voluntary code. It's not going to come into force for some time, though, till 2026. Is that really enough? Is voluntary enough? Is the EU getting it right?
I think voluntary can work. Voluntary can work if it has teeth. We have voluntary regulation for many things. and it's something that can work if it has teeth. And there's different ways to do that. You can design product liability schemes so that people are incentivized to enter into voluntary regulation to be behind liability shields. That's a familiar form of regulatory structure, and it's something that would work in this environment.
What exactly needs to be regulated?
I think one obvious target for regulation is capabilities of models, and another obvious target for regulation is the actual training of the models. So the training of the models can be regulated in exactly the way that we regulate the proliferation of, for example, fissile materials for nuclear regulation. We can regulate the chips, and we can prevent large training runs from happening. And when it comes to the capabilities of the models, credible third-party auditing can be done in order to evaluate them and to say exactly what these things can do.
Is the idea of AI having the capacity to kill people, large numbers of people, is that hyperbole?
I don't think it's hyperbole. I think that if you put AI in charge of things that can themselves cause harm, then the AI can themselves cause harm. I think it's not hyperbole to imagine that people will slowly but surely turn over control of systems to powerful AI, and that those AI will make decisions that cause harm. I think that's not science fiction. That's what people are being incentivized to do.
The likes of ChatGPT has put AI kind of in center of conversations quite what feels like quite quickly. Have we learned the lessons from the likes of social media to be able to have regulation happen fast enough for an area that is developing at this pace?
It looks like we've learned a lesson. One lesson that we appear to have learned is to move quickly with regulation and maybe break some of the companies rather than letting the companies move quickly and break our societies.
Do you think what do you think then are the sorts of upsides? I suppose that the counter argument to that is that the benefits to society will be enormous. Do you buy that? Is the benefit going to be there?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like these systems might have enormous benefits, but they're dual-use technology. So just like we're already using them to engage in drug discovery, it turns out they can be used to discover chemical weapons. So researchers last year just pointed the model in the other direction, and it immediately found 40,000 plus chemical weapons. That very same technology is being used to do drug discovery. So obviously the benefits are enormous, but the benefits only accrue if we get together and make sure they actually accrue. So I don't think anyone would think that the benefits of social media have outweighed the costs that we've paid. Let's hope not to do that again.
With social media, we often hear in the conversation on regulation that because they're US companies, that the US needs to lead on regulation. Is the rest of the world reliant on the US to be able to regulate this, given that so much of the technology is being developed there?
Maybe. So it depends on how serious Europe and the UK want to get. It's not possible to prevent access to the internet from Europe, unless Europe takes a very, very hard line that I don't think it's willing to do. And the same thing goes for the UK. And insofar as the very capable models are being access to the very capable models is being provided via APIs on the internet, then they're just a VPN away. And so to that extent, the rest of the world is being held hostage by US regulatory action. That's not a good thing.
Okay, that's Nate Sheridan, Research Fellow at the Centre for AI Safety, speaking to myself and Caroline Hepker a little bit earlier. Pretty stark warnings about how much needs to be done on this. One of the weighty topics that's going to come up during Rishi Sunak's trip to Washington. We have also been looking at the slightly less weighty items, although perhaps his suitcase might be quite weighty when he gets on that plane later to go to Washington.
Yeah.
Lizzie, you're a bit worried about what he's going to wear.
I do wonder whether he's going to pack those very rugged Timberland boots he's traded his Prada loafers for.
I would just like to point out that it was actually, Lizzie was interested in talking about this. I didn't just ask her about shoes because she's the woman on the programme.
No, I think that it's interesting the kind of statements that politicians try to make through their clothes. Keir Starmer's been rolling up his sleeve to show he's down with the people, and now Rishi Sunak thinks that the way to show the same is by wearing his rugged Tims.
Bit of controversy over how much they cost. £150 according to the Mail, £190 according to the Times. So I guess that makes them sort of... Is that cheap for boots? It's quite a lot of money, isn't it?
How much do you spend on boots? You boots, you're a man.
I haven't got any boots.
Euan is famously frugal, though.
Oh, that
so
is true.
He would only have found the bargains. I'm glad that I correctly remembered this, but it did make me think it's kind of nice that they're talking about a male prime minister's shoes, and with so much attention was paid to Theresa May's shoes. And in fact, if you Google Theresa May's shoes...
I mean, people talked endlessly about Theresa May's shoes, although Theresa May's shoes were far more interesting than Rishi Sunak's shoes.
So much so that there's a Tatler article which is titled In Memoriam to Theresa May's Spectacular Footwear.
Tatler were gutted when she lost the leadership.
So perhaps, who knows, perhaps this is something that we will be working up an item on in the future, Rishi Sunak's shoes. That is it from us for today, though. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Our audio engineer was Marufal Hussain. I'm Euan Potts.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.